Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. Beginning in 2001, Morris Obstfeld of the Peterson Institute for International Economics started publishing research into the causes and consequences of the global imbalances in the world economy. Some countries, notably the US, were running a large current account deficit, while others, China of course, had huge surpluses. At this year's symposium, he revisited the topic. More than two decades later, we are seeing a retreat from globalization, with President Trump's trade policy seeking to overturn that stubborn US trade deficit. What can Morris's work on these imbalances tell us about the path of the US economy in the last two decades, and the consequences of the Trump 2.0 policy promises? Morris, welcome. Hello.
Great to be here, Tim.
You are talking at this conference about global imbalances revisited, and this goes back to those current account imbalances from the 2000s, which were huge. Remind us how huge.
The U.S. attained a current account deficit of roughly 6% of its GDP, which it had never done before and has not done since. That was really the outlier, but other countries had significant surpluses counterbalancing that. The oil exporters, China's surplus grew over this period. Japan's surplus remained sizable. You know, in general, what we saw looking at the data is that the U.S. deficit ballooned, and so surpluses on the other side also ballooned. I'm not implying any causality there, because globally, the sum of deficits and surpluses has to be zero.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at a diagram, it's like a big fan opening in this period.
You originally did work on this around the time of the financial crisis and published on this at that time. We are revisiting now. Why are we revisiting it?
If you look at contemporary politics, particularly in the United States, the deficits of the 2000s cast a very long shadow over the issues that are very contentious today. At the time, China was rising as a global exporting power. Many countries throughout the world imported more from China. The U.S. in particular did, and the outcome is what some researchers have called the China shock, which was basically the loss of manufacturing industries in concentrated areas that were displaced by Chinese imports. Nowadays, when we look at the conflict between the U.S. and China, when we look at the Trump program of tariffs to bring back manufacturing, what's often cited is this period of this years leading up to the global financial crisis, where manufacturing employment in the U.S. truly did plummet, and where the U.S. deficit ballooned, and it's easy to think there's a connection. The other issue is simply the global financial crisis itself, which occurred after U.S. deficits had reached their peak, but which some people link to the deficits. Ken Rogoff and I did a piece published around 2010 on this, trying to sort out the role of global imbalances in the crisis. And in contrast to some people who claim that global imbalances caused the crisis, for example, at the time, Secretary Henry Paulson of the Treasury in the U.S., we sort of viewed the financial crisis, unprecedented U.S. current account deficit, as having common causes. And that's essentially what we explored in that paper. And I think that's correct. And I'm revisiting that now in my research just because of the enormous political consequences and the enormous consequences for what are likely to be the policies of the new Trump administration.
Yes, when you look at the rhetoric of the new Trump administration, it's very much about how that long shadow, these global imbalances, the trade deficits, are something that's been done to the United States. The actions of China specifically did that. Is that an explanation that you give any credit to?
It's remarkable that that narrative which for quite a while was very common on the left, is also the prevailing narrative now on the right. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., there's a new populist right, which is very much about the effect of globalization, allegedly, in stripping the U.S. of manufacturing jobs and stripping the U.S. of wealth. From that analysis follows, you know, the discussion of tariffs and so on. On the left, tariffs are certainly not rejected, but it's led to the Biden administration's approach to industrial policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in both cases, left and right, there's a sense that, you know, manufacturing was denuded by trade, that it's hurt the working class, that we need to bring back manufacturing to restore America to these halcyon days. And there are, you know, different emphases on how to do that, but the analysis is the same. From my perspective, this is a very incomplete picture of what actually happened. You know, for one thing, technological change has been incredibly important in bringing about these developments. And one of the things we see in the data, which is kind of remarkable, is that, you know, in the U.S., manufacturing productivity grew strongly over many decades. This is one reason why manufacturing employment could decline. This higher productivity, the fact that you can produce more manufactured goods with less labor, meant that labor could be released for other purposes, go into the services sector. And starting in 2008, manufacturing productivity simply flatlines in the United States. And at the same time, the rate of decline of manufacturing employment as a percentage of the population sharply decreases. In other words, the very, very sharp fall in manufacturing employment that we saw in the 2000s doesn't come to an end in 2008 completely. Mm-hmm. In fact, as a share of GDP, it still continues to decline slightly, but at a much, much slower pace. And I think that's a clue that a lot of what happened had to do with manufacturing employment. Now, we have to be a little bit careful in trying to say, well, you know, how much was due to trade, how much was due to productivity, because there's reverse causality from trade to productivity.
Yeah.
You know, as a result of globalization, many of the weakest firms exited, the ones that were left almost by definition at higher productivity. So, you know, that's at work too. But by and large, I think most analysts agree that the biggest part of the story was productivity change, you know, which also has led to other tensions in the labor market, the wage gap between high-skilled and low-skilled labor, for example.
Reaching back to the China shock and the consequences of it afterwards, there is an alternative explanation from some of your colleagues for these imbalances at the time, which was the savings glut explanation. Can you quickly tell me what that is and how much you believe that?
Well, it's important to not conflate the savings glut with the China shock. While it is true that China ran surpluses at that time, which were in fact increasing over the 2000s, those were only a fraction of the U.S. total deficit. But the savings glut's story is not so much about China per se, it's more about other countries in East Asia, which had financial crises in the late 90s and began accumulating international reserves. And the basic story there is that because these countries wanted to self-insure, their central banks intervened, they accumulated foreign currencies, their saving rates rose as households also self-insured. And this was a driver of a strong U.S. currency appreciation, which made U.S. goods less competitive and which helped facilitate the U.S. running a large current account deficit. Of course, China is in there. And the other factor that is in there is not just East Asian countries, but energy exporters whose surpluses also rose over the decade. So this has fed a narrative which people associate with Ben Bernanke. He wrote a very famous piece in 2005 on the global saving glut, but others at the time put forth this narrative that the U.S. is basically a passive recipient of foreign savings, which are forcing their way into the U.S. and depressing U.S. interest rates, leading U.S. consumers to consume more, also leading housing prices to go up. And of course, that whole experience has ended in tears in the U.S. and for the world globally. And so a number of researchers also make a link from these global saving glut theories, you know, the idea of foreign capital pushing into the U.S. to the global financial crisis.
Do you fully believe that story?
If you look at the data, I think a judicious conclusion is that that story has some explanatory power in the initial years after the Asian crisis. Though even there, I would be a little skeptical. Part of the reason for that is sort of the behavior of long-term real interest rates in the U.S. doesn't quite conform to the story in those initial years. But you do see a strong appreciation of the dollar and a widening of the deficit. It's a little bit difficult to be definitive because, you know, international transactions data always contains some inaccuracies.
Yeah.
And for that initial period, it turns out that in the IMF's data, which is the sort of best global data we have, some of global deficits significantly exceeds the sum of global surpluses. So in other words, part of the counterpart surpluses to the U.S. deficit and other deficits is not really identifiable as to its source. So we have to be a little bit skeptical about that. But basically, for those years, you can make the case. Now, starting in around 2002, you start to see a precipitous decline of the dollar in the foreign exchange market. Now, this is interesting because the global saving glut story, the standard story, is that capital inflows from abroad in the form of foreign savings come to the U.S., make the dollar stronger.
Exactly.
That gives us in the U.S. a deficit. But here you have the dollar depreciating. Part of the story about manufacturing is that the dollar became so strong that our manufacturing became uncompetitive.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, in the years in which manufacturing employment is falling most rapidly, the dollar is actually falling like a stone.
Ah.
And so what is going on there? You know, how is that consistent with the story? And in fact, over those years, if you look at the data, far from a strong dollar preventing U.S. firms from exporting, U.S. exports are growing pretty strongly.
Right.
The problem is that imports
are growing.
They're growing much more strongly.
Right.
And so the deficit is actually widening as the dollar depreciates, which is, I'm tempted to say, contrary to most people's views of theory, but it's actually not contrary to theory because the trade balance depends on the exchange rate for sure, but it also depends on expenditure. And if people are spending a lot, notwithstanding the fact that the dollar is depreciated, you know, you could have a larger trade deficit. And that's exactly what we see in these years. So something else is going on there that is fueling this incredibly rapid growth of imports.
Both of these stories, the savings glut and the China trade story, are things that happened to the US in their telling. Sounds like you're locating what's happening inside the US as a domestic phenomenon.
Well, two things can be true. There can be capital outflows from outside
Yes.
the U.S., but there can also be a strong U.S. demand for borrowing from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, strong U.S. domestic issuance of bonds. And in fact, I would maintain that starting around 2002 or so, as the housing bubble gets going, U.S. residents are issuing more bonds, they're borrowing more from abroad. And a large part of the story is very easy financial conditions in the US, which promote innovations in the housing market, for example, in mortgage finance, which allow people to realize more of the capital gains that are locked up in their houses. Essentially, financial deregulation, promoting financial ease, and allowing US residents to borrow. And by borrowing, they're issuing dollar bonds in the market. If you want to persuade the market to hold these dollar bonds, the currency is going to depreciate. And that, in my view, is a large part of what's going on in this period. Basically, financial ease is allowing households to borrow more. They're borrowing, they're consuming, they're issuing bonds. This is also, of course, driving the current account deficit to a significant degree. So this is basically pull of capital by Americans from the outside world rather than a push of capital in. And you know, if you look at other indicators, for example, the behavior of long-term interest rates, they didn't really fall all that much over this period, as you would expect if more capital was pushing in and causing the current account deficit to swell. So this is somewhat of a different diagnosis of what is actually underlying the U.S. deficit.
There can be many things simultaneously true, but in policy discussions, there tends to be a dominant narrative. So we come forward to the situation that we're in. today when we are likely to see some quite different policies enacted with a justification based in easing the trade deficit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the risks of these policies are? Is there a potential for them to go badly wrong, considering what you think is likely as the explanations for what's happened in the last 20 years?
Well, there are two main goals of the Trump international economic policy agenda. One is to reduce U.S. deficits. You know, he views deficits as inherently injurious to the U.S., evidence that we are losing from trade and foreigners are gaining from trade. And this view goes back to the mercantilism of the 17th century and even before. He has this idea that deficits result in lost jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we could talk about that quite a bit. Let's not. The other goal is to restore manufacturing.
Yes.
Right. And again, the idea is that deficits, international trade, high levels of imports are associated with fewer manufacturing jobs. We import stuff instead of producing it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely ignores, by the way, the fact that when we import more stuff, we tend to also export more stuff. And some of that is manufacturing.
Yeah.
So there's a proposal for these very high tariffs on all of our trading partners, across the board tariffs. I don't think they're going to succeed in their goal of restoring manufacturing or reducing the trade balance. I mean, theoretically, the trade balance is a macroeconomic phenomenon. It reflects the balance between saving and investment. And in the U.S., at the moment, if you look at the overall saving rate, which is a sum of personal net saving and government net saving, the latter being the government deficit, the sum of those is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the U.S. is investing a lot. Trump would like the U.S. to actually be bringing in foreign investment, which it will if it's productive, if there's deregulation. And so in that setting, you know, the trade deficit can only rise irrespective of what happens to tariffs. It's also very unlikely that tariffs will bring back manufacturing. My colleague at the Peterson Institute, Robert Lawrence, has just put out a landmark volume on manufacturing employment. And what he shows is that across all countries, including China, where manufacturing employment as a share of the labor force peaked around 2013 and has been declining, you know, manufacturing rises in the initial stages of the transformation from an agrarian economy to a manufacturing economy, and then it falls. And it reflects these productivity dynamics that I described to you. You know, as manufacturing becomes more productive, people want more services. And so you need labor in the service industry. So there's kind of a hump shaped, which applies to all economies everywhere. It doesn't matter whether you have a surplus or a deficit. It's kind of an inexorable law of nature. It's very hard for policies of the sort Trump is promoting to go against those trends. So I would expect that he's not going to get very far in succeeding in either of his goals. And I think at that point, he will turn to another tool, which is to depreciate the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's already talked about this idea that a weaker dollar is necessary to reduce the U.S. deficit to promote manufacturing. And as I mentioned to you, in the 2000s, manufacturing employment shrank as a fraction of the total workforce, while the dollar depreciated like a stone. So that's not likely to help, and it's likely to be quite damaging in the sense that, you know, the U.S. is an economy that is booming. It's at full employment. How do you get the dollar to depreciate? Well, you could cut interest rates sharply. The Fed is cutting interest rates. But if you go much further, you really risk stoking inflation.
Yes.
The inflation rate in the U.S. has come down a lot, but it's still proving somewhat stubborn, and you could easily bring inflation back. I think the tariffs that he's proposed will be inherently inflationary. Although tariffs lead to a stronger dollar, the fiscal policy expansion he's proposed in the form of a wide range of tax cuts will also be inflationary and lead the dollar to strengthen. So to bring the dollar down in the face of all that, you really have to get the Fed to do something. And you have an inflationary cocktail that is not very appetizing.
So the possibility here is that the policy prescriptions, it's not just that they're not going to achieve what is claimed for them with the narrative that sits behind them. It's that there is a huge risk, predominantly an inflationary risk, in the next couple of years in the US.
I think that's right. Policies like the tariffs will have very negative effects abroad. And that's another reason to be skeptical of the idea that tariffs will improve the trade balance. One of the most powerful determinants of the level of U.S. exports is the level of foreign activity. When there's recession in foreign countries, they don't spend as much on our stuff. And so if tariffs lead to recessions abroad, U.S. exports are going to fall. And that's not going to be good for the trade balance, nor for manufacturing employment.
We shall have to wait and see what happens in the next couple of years. For now, Morris, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about this topic, then you can download a paper. It's called Misconceptions About US Trade Deficits: Muddy the Economic Policy Debate. It was written by Morris and it's published by the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and that was published in August 2024.
This has been a Vox Talk from the CEPR Paris Symposium 2024. In our next episode, Trump's tariffs in 2018 promised help for the heartland. Did they help? And what were the political as well as the economic consequences?